Welcome to Rock and or Roll. I'm your reluctant host, BJ. Today's episode features a conversation that I had with Frank Sesage, who was in one of the original power pop bands of the 70s, a band from Youngstown, Ohio called Blue Ash. He went on to play with Stiv Bators, writing a lot of the material with Stiv for his amazing solo record, Disconnected. Frank also played with a reincarnation of the Dead Boys around that time, and he went on to play with Jimmy Zero from the Dead Boys in a band in the 80s called Club Wow. He currently has a band called the Deadbeat Poets that are keeping the power pop sound of the 70s and 80s alive today. Frank has a new book out called Circumstantial Evidence that you can order from Get Hip Recordings in the U.S. It's available through Zero Hour Records out of Australia. It was published by an Australian publisher called High Voltage. I think it's available through Barnes & Noble Online. I'm not sure if it's on Amazon, but if you just Google Frank Sesage, that's S-E-C-I-C-H, if you Google that and Circumstantial Evidence, you'll definitely find multiple places where you can order the book. It tells Frank's story of playing in rock bands all through the 70s and 80s up until today. I wanted to have Frank on, not necessarily to rehash the stories he tells in the book, but I just wanted to talk to him about rock and roll in the 70s and about Stiv Bators and just hear some interesting stories about rock and roll over the course of the 70s and 80s. And Frank had a lot of good stories to tell, so check it out. This is the conversation I had with Frank Sesage. So my guest is Mr. Frank Sesage, who has a great new book out called Circumstantial Evidence, which is published by High Voltage. That's an Australian publisher, right, Frank?
Yeah, they're from Perth, Australia, in the western part of Australia.
And that book, it seems like it's being distributed by Zero Hour Records, too, which is also an Australian record label.
Yes, distributed by Zero Hour, and it's in America in Bomp, on Bomp, and Get Hip Records has it everywhere.
Oh, yeah, I saw it. Yeah, I think I ordered it from Get Hip, actually. Okay. So that book chronicles your long and storied career in rock and roll from Blue Ash to the Stiv Bators band. And actually, you were in a revived version of the Dead Boys. And then you were in a band with Jimmy Zero from the Dead Boys called Club Wow, which you could get a great compilation of Club Wow stuff from Zero Hour Records that I mentioned. If you go to Bandcamp, I ordered the CD. You get the download as soon as you order the CD, and then they send you a great CD, DVD package.
Yeah, it's a great package. I was just talking to Jimmy Zero for about 4 hours yesterday on the telephone, so that was fun.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Are you guys talking about trying to do some Club Wow shows? I know.
Not sure yet. He had a very bad accident around Christmas time, so we'll see how he's doing. I'm going to go up and spend some time with him in another month or so when he's ready to have some company. He broke his jaw, fell down the stairs, and multiple operations. Yeah, he was in pretty bad shape still. So I'd like to do something if we could pull it off. All the other guys want to. I know that Billy Sullivan and Jeff West.
So all of those stories are in the book, like I said, Circumstantial Evidence. And I encourage people to get the book, but I had some specific stuff that I'd love to talk to you about, Frank, if that's cool.
Anything you want to talk about, just ramble.
First, I wanted to ask you about, since you were there, I wanted to ask you about the transition from sort of the 60s version of rock and roll to the 70s version of rock and roll, because I think there was a really noticeable shift. I mean, for the most part, if you hear a song, you can usually tell if it came out in the 60s or the 70s. Sometimes it doesn't work out that way, but for the most part, I think you can usually tell. I think 60s rock was simpler. And a lot of it is what came to be called garage rock, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think in the 70s, there was a real shift away from blues to a more complex melodies or more imaginative melodies.
Yeah.
Do you think that's true?
Yeah, a lot of things started happening around 1969 and 70, and things really branched off. Heavy metal became a lot more prevalent. Then the progressive bands like the King Crimson and those things went off in that direction, where, like you were saying, more complex melodies and orchestration kind of things in it. Then you had your singer-songwriters. Then you had a little genre called power pop that actually wasn't called that then, but it was more bands like Blue Ash or Raspberries, Badfinger, Flaming Groovies. Tried to do the 60s kind of melodies with a more Marshall amplified kind of sound, you know?
Yeah.
That's, I guess, we fell into that category.
Yeah, I definitely wanted to talk to you about power pop, too. But I mean, if you listen to a song like Abracadabra, there really wasn't anything like that in the 60s that sounded like that. There's even more than subtle differences, I think. And yeah, I've always tried to figure out what the differences are, what the steps were to go from rock in the 60s to a song like Abracadabra.
It was probably a reactionary kind of thing against the grains of the heavy metal and things that were going like that, even though we used kind of a little bit of a heavy metal sound on that, on some of the Blue Ash things, but it was more of a pop thing where you had the 3-minute pop songs with the melodies and the hooks instead of the jamming kind of thing. And I think, so it was probably a mixture of the 60s kind of things where the 2.5-3 minute pop songs, like a Satisfaction or a, Get Off My Cloud or any of that stuff that was a hit like that, but maybe through bigger amps like Marshalls and Stax and things like that, a heavier guitar sound.
And it was probably also the way stuff was recorded, too. I'm guessing in the 60s, probably most of that stuff was all just the band live in the studio, all playing together.
Yeah, I mean, even Sgt. Pepper was done on a 4-track.
Right.
But by the time you got to 1970, 8-track studios were pretty prevalent. And then there was 12-track studios, and all of a sudden there were 24-track studios in a matter of a few years, you know?
Really, just in a matter of a few years?
Yes, yes, yeah. I can remember going from 8 to 12 to 24.
Yeah, and then recording studios became huge business, too.
Yes.
And then you have all these producers. So I guess the different bands and the different producers and the higher quality studios and just trying new things. But it seems all have happened really fast.
Yeah, actually, when Blue Ash, we actually signed a production contract first with Peppermint Productions in Youngstown that had a 12-track studio, went in and did some demos, and then we had 4 labels that wanted us right away, which was amazing. And then they made the deal with Mercury, but Polydor, MGM, and Metro Media also wanted us. But we were real surprised after our first demos that she got that much action on it. But that's what we actually signed with the production company, then got the major label deal.
And what year was it that you recorded your first demos?
The first ones we ever did was with Bob Mack, who had discovered Tommy James and Sean Dallas, who was the DJ and teen club owner from Pittsburgh, and we did that in 1970.
Okay, but you had formed in the 60s, right?
Yeah, we formed in 1969 when Blue Ash started.
You really were one of those very transitional bands, moving from the 60s into the 70s and kind of...
Yeah, and we were only 18 years old when we started the band. So when we got signed to a major label, we were still only 21,
yeah.
All of us.
And you mentioned the term power pop, which is another thing I wanted to talk to you about, because definitely Blue Ash are always mentioned alongside like the Raspberries and Big Star, and all that stuff came out right there in 72-73. Another band I think about is Stories. They came out in their first record in 72, their second record in 73. Blue Ash's album came out in what I think April of 73.
Yeah.
That early, 72-73, there was just a small handful of bands really that fit into that category that came to be known as power pop.
Yeah, there were only a half a dozen, maybe 10 or so all over the world. Yeah.
Yeah. But you already mentioned Badfinger. I think they were maybe, from what I could tell, since the Beatles broke up in, 1970, I think Badfinger were maybe the most important band in as far as the transition from the 60s to the 70s. I mean, were they really a hugely influential band on other bands?
Oh, yeah. You're probably exactly right on that. That was one of the real bridges into the 70s was those guys.
Yeah, I think Badfinger are one of those bands that they didn't have the massive success with the mainstream, but they were one of those bands, the way they talk about a comedian's comedian.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Badfinger. So if you look at the course of where rock went in the 70s, I think think Badfinger were a huge part of that.
Oh, definitely. They made some great records, that's for sure.
So power pop at the time, it is funny that the power pop that, you know, became really huge in the late 70s, early 80s, really was very 60s influenced. But the stuff that gets mentioned as power pop in the early 70s was moving away from the 60s.
Yes.
So I guess that's why, even though the later power pop has a 60s influence, it still, I guess, stands apart from the 60s. And I guess that's because they also had the influence of all the bands like Blue Ash and Big Star. So it was a combination of things.
Yeah, it's a different kind of hybrid, because we had Blue Ash, Raspberries, and Badfinger, Flaming Groovies. They were more on the rocking side. I mean, we were all club bands. We played in clubs, and that's how we came up to the Midwest and the East. And we were a club band. We were more of a rocker than a power pop band, filtering the melodies of the 60s. But by the time the late 70s and the 80s came in, more power pop bands were more the jangly kind of thing. They took that kind of road from it.
Right.
Where a lot of the Badfinger things, do you think of like Rock of Ages and songs like that, or the Raspberries, I'm a Rocker, Blue Ash, Let the Re-Rock. We were a kind of influence on like a Beatles, Stones kind of 60-ish, you know, Hamburg kind of rock bands too. That influence was in there, and that isn't in a lot of the later power pop bands. That influence is not in there.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Big Star are famously one of those bands that nobody knew who they were at the time, and they became famous, you know, later after they were already gone. But did you guys know Big Star, like,
yeah,
right,
yeah,
when they first came out?
Oh, yeah. I knew the Raspberries real well, and we played a lot of gigs with them. But I knew Alex Chilton, Jim Kendra, and I from Blue Ash met them up at Max's in New York and hung out with them. They were cool guys. The guys from Mercury set that up for us, and we had a lot of fun hanging out. So
would that have been in like 1973?
Yeah, 73.
And was Chris Bell still around then?
Yeah, I think so.
Wow. And were they playing?
Yeah, they were playing Max's Kansas City.
Wow. So you saw that show too?
Yeah, we were there.
Wow, Big Star at Max's Kansas City.
Yeah.
Yeah, and of course the Raspberries. So you guys were from Youngstown?
From Youngstown area. We actually live in Pennsylvania, right over the border, about 10 miles away from Youngstown.
And how far is Youngstown from Cleveland?
55, 60 miles, something
okay,
like that.
So not very far.
Uh-huh, an hour's drive.
So that whole Cleveland scene that happened in the 70s, did that really kind of build up around the Raspberries?
Yeah, I would say the Raspberries, the club scene in Pittsburgh. But there was a whole circuit we used to play, which included Kent, Akron and Canton, Youngstown, Cleveland, and all the way down to Pittsburgh. And all those bands that played that circuit were, you know, you had Raspberries, us, Freeport, Left End, Glass Harp, different bands. A lot of them were signed to major labels out of that area. We played that whole club circuit scene, and there was a lot of places to play back.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, tons of them. Yeah.
Were the Raspberries kind of like a super group because they came out of the choir and Eric was from Cyrus Erie?
Yeah, they were. I always thought the two best bands that ever came out of Ohio were Cyrus Erie and the Holes in the Road, which you've probably never heard of, which were great. They were a cover band. But Cyrus Erie with the McBride brothers and Eric and Wally. The best band that I had ever seen.
We've been going together so long. Can't you feel that there's something wrong? You only take me halfway there. Come on,
come on,
come on,
come on.
We can't go on this way.
And this is in 68, 69. And a lot of Blue Ash was, you know, Jim Kensler and I would go and see him. We wanted to form a band like that, but doing original material. And then we formed about 10 months before the Raspberries did. And Raspberries started in like 70. At the last version of the Raspberries, they got Mike McBride back in the band as the drummer and Scott McCarl. So they were three-fourths of the Cyrus Erie then. And that was when they were the best in 74. And we played with them a few gigs then. And they had the Mellotrons and the Starting Over album.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that was three-quarters of Cyrus Erie there.
Right, right. Yeah. And so, but the original Raspberries, it was two guys from the choir and two guys from Cyrus Erie?
Yes. Well, actually, yeah, I think so, yeah.
Or was Wally in both?
Well, Wally was in both.
So right, okay.
Yeah. You get confused with all of it.
Yeah.
Moving around there.
I mean, that single by the choir, It's Cold Outside, which, of course, you guys did it with Stiv. That's one of the greatest songs of the 60s, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah. Tremendous record.
And that was really ahead of its time, because that's one of those songs that, if that came out in 1980, it would have sounded just perfect in 1982.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was a big hit around here.
Yeah.
When we were kids, we didn't know it was not a national hit. You know, I mean, we were like 15 or 16 when that came out. And that was just like, you heard it all the time. It was just like a national hit to us, even though it didn't go that high in the charts nationally.
Right.
It was played to death in Pittsburgh, Cleveland, and Youngstown, Akron.
Oh, it's such an amazing song.
Oh, yeah, great song.
I can't believe it wasn't a bigger hit.
Yeah.
Well, my world used to be sunny. Jokes used to be funny, but now you're gone and everything's turned all around. Well, my world used to be warm and then there was a storm, but now you're gone and everything's turned upside down.
Well, you mentioned the band Left End, and I wanted to ask you about them. Do you know that issue of Bomp Magazine, the Power Pop issue? Do you remember that? It came out in 78?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a whole article in there about the Cleveland scene, and they talk about Left End. I have that Left End record. I don't think it's really that great, but, I mean, they obviously must have been a really fun band to see live.
Oh, they were fun. They were friends of mine. We played a lot of gigs with them, actually. We rehearsed at the same place with them, the same rehearsal place, split it with them. So I knew those guys fairly well, you know. And their singer, Dennis, just died last year.
Oh, really?
He's a great guy, yeah.
Dennis T. Menace.
I'm still in contact with those guys on Facebook and everything. And we had a lot of fun during the years with them. They were a little different than us. They were more of a Alice Cooper, almost maybe a heavy metaler kind of band, you know.
Yeah, when you look at the album, it sounds a lot different once you listen to it than what you would expect.
Yeah.
According to that Bomp Magazine, it says that they used to tell a story. Left End told a story that their manager threw the New York Dolls road manager down the stairs.
Yeah, there was all kinds of stories like that. I don't know how much, if any of that, or any of that is true, but that was always around in the local papers then.
Yeah, and then it says that that same manager that threw the guy down the stairs is the guy who produced your second album, the second Blue Mash
album. Yes, he was.
Yeah, I doubt if that story is true either, but I guess they were trying to create fake rivalry.
Get in the paper. Yeah.
So did you see the New York Dolls back then?
Oh, yeah, I was hanging out with them all the time because we were label mates at Mercury.
Right, yeah.
So whenever we'd go to New York, we'd be at Max's with them or go to the clubs or hang around the offices or just go out. Yeah, we were good friends with them.
You know, I always see this. It seems like a common theme that the New York Dolls weren't very good musicians. But when I listen to those records, they sound great.
Yeah, I like the records an awful lot. I always thought they were real good.
I mean, was that true that people didn't think they were very good musicians?
That was true. That was what people would think at the time. But there was a lot of backlash about a lot of things then. There was a lot of backstabbing and things then. I mean, any of the bands that were successful from around this area, they got major label contracts. There was always people, you know, saying stuff. I mean, the Raspberries got a lot of crap from everybody. So did we, you know. And there's that's just was the local kind of jealousy kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just happened. And, you know, people would just get, you know, funny about stuff. If you got a major label or got signed up, you had a hit or something, they would always try to denigrate it in some way here, which was odd. But, you know, now it's revered all over the world, you know.
Yeah.
And cult following and stuff. But it was strange back then. And that's, you know, people would say that about the Dolls. Anybody that was something new and you know, they're not Led Zeppelin, but I mean, Led Zeppelin's Led Zeppelin. It's not, you know what I mean? It's a whole different thing. It's apples and oranges. You're not comparing, you know.
Yeah.
Musicians in that way. I've never understood that, you know. You have to take everything on its own merits.
Right, exactly. The New York Dolls were trying to do something different. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
I wanted to ask you, did Blue Ash ever cross paths with Kiss at all?
No. Never met any of them or talked to any of them or ever played any of them, which is odd because they were coming around the same time too, but we never did.
I wanted to go through some of those other bands that were on the Cleveland scene that they talk about in that issue of Bomp magazine. Well, I wanted to ask you about Don Chris. Did you know him?
I met him once or twice, but I didn't really know him that well.
Okay, he was in a band called Mongrel, I guess.
Don't remember that.
Yeah, there's a whole list of bands they list in there. Magic.
I remember Magic. I remember Circus. They were very good.
Yeah, Circus. Their album is really good.
They were a good band. I don't know if you knew Freeport. Come across. They were really good. And Kevin Raleigh was in that. He ended up in the Michael Stanley band. And they had Myron Grumbacher on drums for a while, who ended up playing with Rick Derringer, then with Pat Benatar on all her hits in her band.
Right. Did Freeport have an album?
Yeah, it was on that mainstream label.
Angela.
I'm just fascinated by all of the different bands that never really got a record deal, or but you know, I bet there were still a lot of great bands that were just kind of lost.
Like the Trolls, Jimmy Zero and I were talking about them yesterday on the telephone, and they were fantastic. But they never really got a record deal, and they opened up for all kind of people, you know, famous bands and everything. During that time, when we were growing up, we would just go to the local record hops and everything. And every night you'd see somebody that was like a world-class band around here. The right. competition was so fierce, you had to be so good. And I remember when Stiv Bators and I first went to California, he would take me out to see bands in 78, 79. We'd go to clubs. These bands were absolutely garbage crap, you know. And they, a lot of them became very famous. I won't tell you who they are or anything. And I would tell them after, why do you drag me to see bands like this? They couldn't even get a job in Youngstown, you know? And then they'd become these big famous bands.
Yeah.
But it was just so funny. That's how high caliber the talent was around here.
So speaking of Stiv Bators, I wanted to ask you about his whole history. So what was his first band? Was it the Mother Goose band?
First band he was in was a Mother Goose. That I remember him being in was the Mother Goose band. And he pretty much took my place. He was my replacement because I quit the band in 69 to start Blue Ash. And then the guys that kept the band going got him in right after that. And they became a different kind of band. They were more of a show-style band, Alice Cooper thing, a lot of theatrics and stuff like that. I have a video of it that's very, very rare, an 8-minute video of the Mother Goose band from back then. It's absolutely fantastic. But I promised the guy who gave it to me that I would never put it on the internet to just get a copy. And I gave it to Stiv's parents and I gave it to Karen Wagner, who was in the actual video. They used her as a sacrificial virgin. And she was a friend of mine, Stiv's from high school and stuff. So I gave it to her and she passed away and she was so thrilled to get it. That's the only reason I wanted to get a copy. But I still haven't put it out anywhere because I promised the guy from Seattle. He bought it for a lot of money, and the guy that had made the video, so I can't put it on the internet or anything. But you'd love to see this thing. It's fantastic.
And is that a silent video?
Yeah, it's a silent video.
Yeah. I would. Yeah, did Stiv have really long hair then?
Yes.
And were they doing makeup and costumes and everything?
They had, yeah, different kinds of things like that.
Yeah, wow. And they were doing original material?
I don't think it was original. It looked like they. I don't think they were doing much originals then.
Okay.
So I remember Stiv bringing tapes around with him singing a couple of originals. I can actually remember it, and it actually sounded pretty good. But this would be about 70 or 71. But God knows whatever happened to those.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And then in your book, you mentioned the Stiv Bator Band. So was that between Mother Goose and Frankenstein, maybe?
I think it was just like a pickup band he had, you know?
Okay.
The first time that I ever remember bringing him on stage, it was in the summer of 69. It was before Blue Ash, but me and Steve Acker, who was in a band called Law, that's another one that was really good around the Cleveland area. They were on MCA Records and actually discovered by Roger Daltrey. And I got Steve Acker, Myron Grumbacher played Pat Benatar and Bill Gendrick, the first guitarist from Blue Ash. And we brought Stiv on stage just to have a pickup band play this like a little pop festival. It was an outdoor thing in our area. And it's the first time I ever remember him on stage. And he split his head open with the mic stand and was shaking a can of whipped cream in his crotch. I ended up having to take him to the spraying it out all over the audience. And I ended up having to take him to the hospital to get stitches. And a big gash in his head, he hit himself in the head with the mic stand.
Did he do that on purpose?
I don't think so. He threw it up in the air and it caught him on the way down, you know? So,
But even in 1970 or whatever, Stiv Bators was bleeding and spraying whipped cream in his crotch.
69, yeah. And right after that, he was in the Mother Goose Band. That's the first time I ever remember him on stage. And it was just a pickup thing. We were doing like maybe MC5 songs, Pick Up the Jams, Stray Cat Blues, the Stone song, things like that. We just did like a 30-minute set and stuff we all knew. We didn't even rehearse.
And at that point, did you guys already know about the Stooges and Iggy Pop? Or no?
Yeah, it might have been. It might have been right around that summer, the '69. Yeah.
So, yeah, Stiv probably was pretty influenced by Iggy then already, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I remember him calling me because that was the year of the Cincinnati Pop Festival down at Crosley Field, and the Stooges played, and they had this one that's on film, and Iggy smeared the peanut butter on him. And I remember Stiv calling me from Cincinnati saying he was the one that gave him the peanut butter. So that's been the legendary thing of all that time, you know?
Yeah.
So he was a big Iggy fan.
Yeah. So do you know around what time Frankenstein started?
Blue Ash, we were playing in Cleveland a lot, and I remember he brought all those guys down to see us at Jicky's, I think. And that's where I first met Cheetah and Jimmy Zero. 73, 74, right around that time.
And so how did it work with Rocket from the Tombs, too? Were they at the same time?
That was right around the same time, too. And then they merged or split up. And that's where Perubu and then the Frankenstein went, and then the Dead Boys.
Right.
Yeah.
And so Cheetah was in... He was in Rocket from the Tombs, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then he ended up in Frankenstein.
Yeah. And then they were also in and out of bands like Pete Lochner. And then Terry Hartman, who's in the Deadbeat Poets now with us. And he was real good friends with Lochner and made recordings with him. And so there was a lot of interaction and all that, you know?
Yeah.
That area there. But all those guys were also talented. Really, really great songwriters and players. And weren't very well liked around Cleveland, as you probably know, too. And like I said, a lot of people weren't. Even the Raspers, there's backlash against anyone who had something very different. There were a lot of top 40 bands back then. And they would think they were hot, you know, crap because they could, you know, mimic top 40 things. It was a weird scene. But then I guess the backlash out of all that came was all the cool bands that came out of the Cleveland and Akron and Youngstown area. So there's a lot of stuff going on back then.
Yeah. Even Devo was going on.
Tons of stuff like that. Yeah. Yep. Exactly.
So do you remember how the transition from Frankenstein to the Dead Boys happened? Or...
I don't remember too much about that. I just all of a sudden remember Frankenstein. I remember them coming down to Youngstown a couple times, and they'd hang out at Jeff Jones's place, Cheetah and Stiv, and we'd hang out there. Jeff was our manager and managed a lot of the bands around here. Blue Ash's manager. Then all of a sudden, I remember it was the Dead Boys, and they were going to New York, you know?
We'll be right back.
So Frankenstein, we're probably still doing more of like the Mother Goose type Alice Cooper thing, but at some point they cut their...
Yeah, started with the originals because Jimmy and Cheetah were great songwriters. Yeah, and Stiff could write too, so...
And at some point they cut their hair.
Yes.
That must have been the big change, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think once they went to New York, that happened. Yeah.
How much did the sound of the band change from Frankenstein to the Dead Boys? Was it drastic or was it...
I don't think it was that drastic, no. Huh?
Yeah.
No.
So when...
Both bands were good and they were rockers. I mean, they had the material and they had the goods, so there wasn't that much of a change.
But the Dead Boys are such a classic punk rock band.
Yeah, yep. And just it was more... The fashion changed more than the sound.
Right.
The Dead Boys were a great band live. They were one of the best bands I'd ever seen live. And I would get slack from people around here for saying that, but I always thought they were fantastic live.
Oh, they must have been so much fun.
Power, and every time I ever saw them live, they were great. And I'd put them right up with live shows like The Who or something like that, but they never got... The first album was really good, but the second album on the Dead Boys, they just never got that live sound that they had. You know, they were a fantastic live band.
Yeah, there's a very different sound between the two, but I love the second Dead Boys
album. Oh, I love the second album, too. I like a lot of the songs. My favorite Dead Boys song is, of all times, I Won't Look Back, Jimmy's song.
Yeah, that's my favorite.
Really, I always thought that was their best song, and I thought that could have been a smash hit.
Oh, it's an amazing song. I was going to ask you, why did it take so long between the first Blue Ash album and the second album? It was, what, 4 years?
Yeah, what was funny is that we had to sell a certain amount of, as you probably read in the book, albums, and we didn't quite hit that goal. We got close to it. They gave us one more single, then they let us go. But a lot of other labels were really interested in us because we had such great press. And Columbia, right after that, 74, flew us up to New York. We had a big audition. Everything looked like it was going there. At the last minute, it would fell through. RCA was next like that. And then even Nat Weiss, who was the Beatles' American lawyer, and Brian Epstein's good friend, he came down. He owned Emperor Records and had the Romantics and different things. There was more of a jazz label. It was a great label. And he came down, spent the whole weekend with us and loved the band and was going to sign us. And both not to sign with anybody else. And then that fell through. But it was really weird. So finally, when we got the offer with Playboy in 76, we just took it because we just wanted to make a record again. And then that became kind of a disaster. They picked songs, and the producer we were talking about, it was things that we really didn't want to do. And that's one of my least favorite records of all time that I've ever been on. And I just didn't like the way it came out. And right after that, really broke up our band, even though that thing sold pretty well, because it had like a semi-regional hit single on it and stuff. But it was just not what I wanted to do with the band. And right after that, then Blue Ash had been together 10 years, and Steve was just winding down with the Dead Boys. And that's when we started doing the Bomb stuff and did the demos up in Cleveland in 78. And he took them to L.A. and played them for Greg Shaw, It's Cold Outside, the last year, and a few other ones. And Greg signed us to a recording contract.
Maybe I just wanna tell you lies so I can have your kid. And what a world to do my bid, so I can have fun. I'm an evil boy. I'm an evil boy. I'm an evil boy. I'm an evil boy. I sit up all night and think of evil things to do. And I've got something very special planned for you.
Disconnected really is a power pop record.
Yeah, pretty much it is. Yeah, I would say.
And it was released by Bomp Records, which, you know, that was home base pretty much for power pop then. And were you out? Were you living out in L.A. then?
Yeah, we were in L.A. for most of the 79 and 80. I bet you half the time we were in L.A.
And that's when everything was happening, when the Knack took off.
Yeah, definitely. Yep. And the records, they had a big hit, Starry Eyes, that summer, and they had recorded one of my songs that was on their debut album, well, the EP that came with it, Abracadabra.
Right.
Yeah, so I met them out at the Midnight Special when they did that in summer 79, Bader's and I were out there.
And all those bands were happening in in L.A. then, like 2020 and the Plimsolls.
Yeah, I was hanging out with all those guys. Haley Brothers, Ramones were out there doing... Rock and Roll High School album, and all those bands were out there. 2020 was a good band. I saw them a couple times out there, and Phil Seymour was out there a lot. Hung out with him, and
I love Phil Seymour. His records are great. Yeah,
yeah. And a lot of us would always stay at that Tropicana Motel, the famous Rock and Roll Motel. So a lot of the bands were always there on Santa Monica Boulevard near La Cienega there.
Yeah.
We even lived out there. Greg had got Steve and I a bungalow, and our next door neighbor was Tom Waits.
Really?
Yeah. Having a party Saturday night. You guys are invited. Comes to the door one day.
Steve Bader's hanging out with Tom Waits? And that's
he didn't go, though. I went to the party. He was doing something else. I ended up there, though, so it was funny. And our other neighbor was Chuck E. and Ricky Lee Jones. Remember Chuck E.'s in Long?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And he has a band called Chuck E. and the Goddamn Liars or something like that. No, he's not. He was our other neighbor.
And Ricky Lee Jones and Tom Waits, they were together at some point, weren't they?
Yeah. That was the whole neighborhood.
Yeah.
There were all these little bungalows that were part of the Tropicana Motel, and they'd rent them out to... You know, bands. Iggy lived out there too at the time.
So, what was a Tom Waits party in 1979 like?
It was wild. I just remember going. I was pretty drunk when I went there, but if we just ended up there and hanging out, it was nice. It was fun, you know.
Yeah.
But he had come to the door. Oh, you know, you guys are invited. That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
And people like Kim Folley would be there all the time to show up.
Dee
Dee Ramone, he was always, you know, knock on the door and he was knocking. And this is Dee Dee. And I go, Jesus Christ, it's five o'clock in the morning. He goes, you want to go drink? And I said, it's 5 in the morning. He goes, you want to go to breakfast? I said, okay. So I get up. Yeah, that's the kind of things that would happen every day.
Yeah.
He'd have runaways around, and the Go-Go's, they weren't famous yet, but they were always around, you know?
Oh, yeah, the Go-Go's are great.
Yeah, they were always.
They were still kind of a punk band then.
Yeah. Huh? Yeah. But they were, a lot of people, like, would just hang out at that hotel. So there were always musicians there all the time. Nick Lowe and all of those, a lot of those British guys were out there, too. Levi and the Rock Cats, we were friends with them and hung out with them a lot, and they lived out there too. So that was like the rock and roll little community, the Tropicana Motel and the bungalows that went along with it.
Yeah.
Wild time. They painted the pool black. It was the black swimming pool. We took the pictures for it's cold outside, sleep right there. At the pool at the truck can.
So when Stiv Bader's hooked up with Greg Shaw, obviously the plan must have been just to make a power pop record, right?
Yeah. We made the Cold Outside single first, and then later that summer we recorded Not That Way Anymore and Circumstantial Evidence, which is the title of my book, where I got that from. And then toured all over those whole 2 years. We were touring constantly, too. And then did the Disconnected album in the summer, August and September of 1980. And it came out the week John Lennon was killed. Actually, the day he was killed, in December of 1980.
Yeah, and that is such a great record, such a classic.
I get more email and letters on that than anything, and I get them every day on that. Somebody old from Finland or Australia will say they love this, you know?
Yeah,
they love the record, and it's continues to sell, and they put it out in different forms and everything in all kinds of countries, so it's fine, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of too bad that it didn't come out on a major label, because that could have been a hit record even.
Yeah, it could have been.
Major labels sniffing around Stiv then, or?
Yeah, there were, but what happened was when that album came out, and after we had mixed it, he went over to England and then hooked up with the Wanderers, who just got a deal with Polydor, so he signed with them and wanted to do the Wanderers and the Stiv Bader's band at the same time, and neither one of us bands wanted to do that. Because it just wasn't feasible. I mean, you're talking about two bands on two different continents, you know, across an ocean. And then their thing didn't hit up, so we kind of split up after that. Then he started the Lords of the New Church the next year after that. But yeah, we had a lot of offers. We wanted to pick that up and do it, but for contractual reasons and everything, we just couldn't do it.
So it ended up that he chose the Wanderers over keeping the Stiv Bader thing going?
Pretty much, because we didn't want to do both of them. We told them we're not going to do both of them.
Yeah. So I like the Wanderers record, but
I did too.
Disconnected is way better.
It was just not feasible to do. How can you have two bands on two different continents? I mean,
yeah.
If you're Rod Stewart, maybe you could do it, you know? But, you know what I mean? It was just not feasible.
The Wanderers was basically, I think it was the band Sham 69, he just basically replaced their singer, Jimmy Percy,
yeah.
Right? And then
yeah.
They just changed the name?
Yep, pretty much.
I wonder why he would choose that over his own solo thing.
Well, I think because of the lure of going to England and recording for a major label over there and Yeah. And he was so in awe of those guys being Sham 69 or something. I think that had a lot to do with it.
Yeah.
It's a shame because it would we could have done really well with that.
Yeah, you had such a great band, too.
Mm-hmm. We just had a little reunion for the first time in November. George Cabanis is the guitar player. He plays in a band over there now, and we hooked it up. Me and David Quentin would join them on stage. So David came down from Canada, and we surprised him, and we all got up and did some of the stuff from Disconnected.
Wow.
With his band. So it was a lot of fun. That was in November. I'm disconnected away.
Yeah, right. I wanted to talk to you about Club Wow. I think my favorite song on that whole Club Wow thing is the song Pants and Jackets.
Oh, yeah. Really good. That's great.
Yeah, that's a great song.
That's one Jimmy and I wrote.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, thanks. It's one of my favorites, too. It's different, you know? I like the title.
So Club Wow, you just never got a record deal?
Yeah, that's what happened is then when Stib was forming in Lords of the New Church, and then Jimmy already had Club Wow together, but they didn't have a bass player. There he is, the studio guys. They made a couple recordings. And Jimmy, Billy, and Jeff West, who played in the Testers with Sonny Vincent.
Yeah, I love the Testers, yeah.
Yeah, they're great. And I just talked to Jeff the other day. They were doing stuff, and they asked me, on New Year's Day, they called me and asked me to play in the Club Wow. And I just jumped at it because I knew how good musicians they were. So we practiced, played our first gig, I think April 1st of 1982. And then we just started recording. We put out one single. It was just a local thing, Prettiest Girl. But then we recorded, sent them out to major labels, and we play once or twice a month, you know, at the Fantasy of the Eagle or something, or down in Cleveland at Cedars in Youngstown. And we got a major label showcase in the end of 84, beginning of 85, up in New York, and there rehearsed, and had a lot of people come down to see us. Couldn't get a deal. And I don't know why. It was a great band. And I think just after 3 years of doing it all the time, I would drive, I was 100 miles from my house to Cleveland for practice, and I was working full-time managing a record store and driving that 3 or 4 times a week to practice it, 8 hours of practice thing. So it had taken its toll on me, too. And I still love all those guys like Brothers, and I'm glad that stuff all finally came out.
Yeah, so Club Wah was two guys from the Testers and then Jimmy Zero and you?
No, just Jeff West from the Testers.
Just one drummer, guy.
Me, Jimmy Zero, and Billy Sullivan. He was in different bands too, around Cleveland. And then he plays in Herman's Hermits now with Peter.
Right.
He's been
right.
In the last 3 years. He did a lot of those oldie shows, but he's with Peter all the time. They play tour constantly.
The Testers were a New York band, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Testers never had a record, but they had singles, and I have a couple of different CD compilations of them, I think.
Yeah, they were on a couple singles.
I think Club Wow probably was just a little too late. The power pop thing had kind of fizzled out, and a few years earlier, you probably would have got a deal. But
I think so. If it would have been 79, we would have fit right in.
Yeah. And speaking of being too late for the power pop thing, I mean, then you worked with those guys in the Infidels. Which, I mean, they were great.
Great band.
Infidels times 4 is amazing.
I always thought that was their best thing we ever did. We did that in Canton. I produced that. And I always just loved the compression on that record because we had to smash it down to get it on 2 songs on each side of the single. And it gives a real powerful kind of recording thing to it. It's different than almost anything you'll ever hear. And I've always gotten a lot of good mail on that, you know. Cause when you make records on a groove, once you go past on a 45, in the 4 minutes, you start losing fidelity, you know?
Yeah.
You probably know. So when you have to put 2 songs on an EP like that, you kind of have to smash them down and then use a compressor to make them jump a little bit, you know? And I just always like the way those things sounded on that. Yeah.
Yeah, it does sound different.
Yeah.
I've already played the song "Take One More Look" on the podcast. I've done a few episodes of power pop stuff, and I played that song at some point. I think that's a great song.
Take one more look to see what's in front of you. Take one more look to see what you're gonna do. Take one more look and step straight into my eyes and say I'm leaving here as if it's no surprise. And time will come and it will chase us.
Well, right now, with the Deadbeat Poets, three of the infidels are in the band now. John Lumick right now has replaced Terry Hartman, who I believe he has some health problems and everything. So, and then John Corey, the drummer, and Peter Beer, the lead guitar player, and me are the Deadbeat Poets now.
That's oh, wow, so now you've got three of them, man.
Yeah, I got three of us now. And we're going to Spain in June to tour there. Our album, we've got a new album out there on New York Cosmos Records. And we'll be touring from June 8th through the 20th in Spain, all over Spain. We're playing a big festival there, too, in San Sebastian.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. And yeah, we're rehearsing tonight, so I'll tell them you played that song.
Oh, that's a great song, yeah. Yeah, they were a great band. You talk about how you met them when you were working at the record store, and they were...
Yeah, they came up with the Disconnected album, Pete and John.
Right.
Slapped it down with $10, and I said, what kind of sickos are you guys to buy crap like this? And this guy got real offended, you know? And I'm laughing. He goes, oh, Stiv's great, man. And then I said, turn the record over. I pointed to my picture. I go, that's me. And then they said, oh, you know?
Yeah.
He'd come down and hear our band, so I went down and heard him. That's how I got involved with him. Funny story. And now I'm in a band with him now.
Yeah, right. Yeah, they were one of those, I would sort of consider them a power pop band, but they had a real heavy 60s psychedelic influence going on.
Oh, yeah.
And you mentioned in the book also when you were working at that record store that Trent Reznor used to always come in.
Yeah, he was one of the kids that hung around there all the time. He was always in there. It's just so funny, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I can picture him being in there all the time. He was always there. Well, it was the only record store around where he lived at, you know?
Yeah.
Made sense. I mean, we were the only record store pretty much in the mall there. He lived in Mercer, which is about 8-10 miles east of the Hermitage where I live and where the mall was at, where the store was at.
Did you have any idea back then that he was planning on having a music career or anything?
Oh, I knew he was in little bands and stuff like that around. I knew that, you know? But yeah, he was always a cool kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. I consider him a kid. He was younger than me. He was one of the teenagers that, like, hung out there, you know?
Yeah.
Funny stuff. A lot of talented people hung out in that store.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you if you knew Chrissy Hynde before she moved to London. Was she a part of the scene in the 70s?
Yeah, but I had never met her. I didn't know her. I met her brother a couple times from the Numbers band there. But I didn't know her.
Her brother was in a band?
Yeah, he was in a band called the Numbers Band, Terry Hynde.
Oh, okay.
That used to play, there were a bar band playing at JB's in Kent a lot.
Wow.
We'll be right back. people get you down. Bitter is where the jive artist time is from. Be looking in, on, playing no damn eye game, think be gone, playing no eye game.
One other band you mentioned in the book that I wanted to ask you about, because I don't really know anything about them, but I really like their album, is the Rubber City Rebels.
Yeah, yeah. Good guys. And they were on Capitol. They got signed through the Knack, through Doug Figer.
Okay.
They opened up for the Dead Boys when I was with them at Whiskey A Go-Go, when John Belushi got up. We played there twice, two residencies there for 3 days, two shows a night. And they opened up for us all the time out there. But we used to always, when we'd come out, hang out, they were with them and they were out in L.A., and we'd always bring them Stroh's beer. That was the first thing we'd ask for. I'd always bring them a six-pack. If you couldn't get it out in California, then they missed it from Ohio.
Yeah, they were from Ohio and they moved to L.A. That's how they got signed,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm, yep.
So when you were out there with Stiv, they were out there at the same time?
Yeah, we were all hanging out together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so... They were a weird band. I mean, their record is very eclectic. Like, there's some kind of novelty type songs, or there's, you know, kind of songs with a sense of humor.
You know, Stiv gave them that name, the Rubber City Rebels, too.
Really?
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that he actually gave them that. They were looking for a name. They were named something else, but I couldn't remember that. That doesn't make. He goes, try Rubber City Rebels. You should call yourself.
Where did he come up with that from?
But, yeah. What?
Did he just make that up, or was there something called Rubber City? No.
No, he just made it up.
Yeah, it's a cool name.
Yeah.
So you already mentioned your band Deadbeat Poets, which is still going right now, but you said Terry's not in the band anymore.
And Terry's not in the band anymore, and John's take playing bass, and I switched over to rhythm guitar.
And you have a new record. Is it out yet?
Yeah, we have a new record out right now called Strange Tales from the Husband Building, which is kind of a greatest hits. It's like our eighth album. And the new one's coming out. It's going to be El Camino Real Highway 101. In Spain. It's got 3 or 4 new songs on it, and it'll be out in May. And we'll be touring Spain in June. And we're bringing Jim Kenzer from Blue Ash with us, too, because there's been a lot of Blue Ash reissues doing really well in Spain. So we're going to do it kind of like the Parliament Funkadelic. We're going to do a Deadbeat Poets set, take a break, and then do a Blue Ash set. And have me and Jim, the remaining guys from Blue Ash, on it.
Oh, awesome.
So it's going to be a kind of cool tour, yeah. Except that I'll have to play twice. but that won't be too bad, though. It'll be fun.
Yeah. Yeah, there was that reissue called Around Again on Not Lame, or not a reissue, but like a collection of Blue Ash unreleased stuff,
yeah.
And now there's a new thing, I haven't heard it yet, called Hearts and Arrows.
Yeah, that's the label, that's from Spain. And that's the label that's bringing us over there to the Blue Ash, and the Deadbeat Poets are putting out the new Deadbeat Poets song, too. And that's a great compilation. It's got 28 songs, none of them ever been on vinyl before. About 20 of them are from the Not Lame thing, but there's 8 songs that have never been released anywhere before. And it has an extra EP, too, with demos on it, 7-inch EP. It's a great set.
Is that only on vinyl?
Only on vinyl.
Okay.
It's a double album gatefold, and the EP's on the inside of it, 7-inch EP.
And that just came out last year?
Yeah, it just came out toward the end of the year, yeah.
Okay.
And it's still selling really good. Get Hip distributes it here, and it's selling all over the world, so we're going to go and promote that over in Europe.
Yeah, I'm going to have to get my hands on that.
Yeah, you like it. It's a lot of fun. It's a really good album.
So at the Deadbeat Poets, you guys have been, how long have you guys been together now?
Since 2006.
2006, and you've got a really classic power pop sound. Just a
thanks, DJ.
You haven't tried to modernize it at all. You're just, you know, doing your thing.
Yeah, just doing what we do. We keep doing them. Yeah, and we keep writing some good songs. So it's keeping going. Yeah, hopefully Terry will be back with us again, so we'll just put him on as acoustic. Harpier wants to come back,
Yeah, I really like that Joe the Minor Bird song.
Oh, thank you. That's a true story.
Yeah, it's really good.
And another Spanish label put that on an EP, so we'll be promoting that over there too. So.
Kept our small mind.
we do that live, it sounds really good. It's a good song.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I guess Little Steven's a big fan of you guys, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We've had three cool songs in the world on his show, and yeah. He actually picked one. My book is one of the 10 best books for Christmas gifts this year, so that was nice.
So you've got the new Blue Ash, you've got the new Deadbeat Poets album coming out.
Club Wow.
Yeah, you've got the Club Wow thing out on Zero Hour, which is highly recommended.
You know, and Zero Hour is going to put out later on this year, too, the an 8-CD so far, Blue Ash set, of all the rest of the demos we did at Peppermint. It's going to be about 160 songs altogether. This concert we did with the Raspberries at Packard Music Hall is going to be on there. It's going to be 8 different discs and really a good kind of deal. Yeah.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, so it'd be pretty cool. That'll be everything Blue Ash ever did on that.
With this many years in the music business and, you know, here you are in 2016 and you've got all this stuff going on and you're still very active and you know, it must feel great to have done it for this long.
It's funny. I laugh about it every day. I rehearse every day because we're doing all this stuff and we rehearse with the band tonight. We'll do that. But I'm doing a book tour too, where I start in Florida April 2nd. I go down there for about 2 weeks. I'm going to do all the South and everything. And the rest of the year, a lot of stuff. So I do kind of a thing with an acoustic 12-string where I do a lot of the songs and tell stories about them and that too. So I'm having more fun with it now at my age than ever, BJ. It just,
yeah.
It just strikes me really funny. And I'll do it as long as I can. I have fun with it. I have nothing else to do. Like I said, I had a really bad injury last May. I had ripped my back up, and I was laid up. That's when George from High Voltage wanted me. He'd been after me to do the book. And I told him I never had the time. He goes, well, now you had the time. So I did it in 3 months worth the book. Worked 8 to 10 hours on it a day, and now it's really paying off a lot of dividends. So I'll go out and promote it, and it's selling well. People enjoy it, so I'll go out and tell my stories. I got nothing better to do, so. And I love riding on trains, so that's fun. I take the Amtrak everywhere.
Oh, you take Amtrak everywhere?
Yeah, yeah. I love to go that way.
Where else are you going to be going for your book tour?
Well, I start in April 2nd in St. Petersburg, then I'm going to Tampa, Orlando, Jacksonville, and Miami, then to Atlanta and Nashville, I think Memphis. I'll head out west later on, but I'm going to be in Toronto May 28th, and then I'm doing a Cleveland date at the Grog Shop on April 27th. So, and more, I have a lot more lined up, but I'm trying to put it all together to make it feasible. So there'll be a lot more. Now, so, Pittsburgh, too, on May 14th, which we're going to do a preview before we go to Europe of the Deadbeat Poets Blue Ash show. So that'll be fun. Right at Get Hip on Saturday, May 14th. So that'll be a fun one, too. And we're playing Cedars and doing the same thing in Youngstown on April 30th.
Wow. Wow.
So a lot of stuff coming up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you so much for talking to me, Frank. It was great.
Hey, thank you. Thank you, Biggie. Take care.
Yeah, congrats on the book, and, you know, good luck on your tour and everything.
Okay, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Alright, so I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Frank Sesich from Blue Ash and the Stiv Bators Band, and check out his current band, the Deadbeat Poets. Check out his book, Circumstantial Evidence. And now, to play us out.
What does that mean, to play us out? I don't know what that means, to play us out. What does that mean? To end the show?
Yeah.
I'm going to leave you with the song that gave Frank's book its title, Circumstantial Evidence, song by Stiv Bader's band featuring Frank on bass guitar, co-written by Frank and Stiv. This was the B-side of the second single that they did for Bomp Records. The A-side was Not That Way Anymore. The B-side was this song called Circumstantial Evidence. Till next time.